Louise Erdrich's latest published work, her 11th novel and 13th book, opens with the brutal murder of a white family in their North Dakota farmhouse in 1911. A group of local vigilantes blames four Indians from a nearby Ojibwe reservation for the crime and then rounds them up and lynches them. Ms. Erdrich's story follows the adventures or the what happens to the descendants of these unjustly accused Indians whose lives become entangled with those of the children and grandchildren of the men who'd meted out such rough justice against their ancestors. The Plague of Doves is published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings Louise Erdrich back to the show today. Hello.
Hi, I'm very pleased to be back.
You've said that you've lived with this story for many years. Personally?
I began thinking about it when I came across an historical anecdote that just mentioned this. I didn't know about it. And I think that was almost 18 years ago.
So how many books have you written while this novel was still vegetating in the back of your brain?
I don't know. But I did work on bits and pieces of this, and then I would put it aside. It's almost as though I couldn't really approach the material. I hadn't the perspective on it. So it took me a long time to write the pieces that I thought would fit together and flow. In fact, I didn't think I was writing a book for quite a while. You know, I started another book. It was a science fiction novel, and I was writing on my great science fiction novel, writing away, and I would take time off from that novel to do something that was so compelling to me, and that was this book. I didn't know I was writing this book. And
but you were writing it as short stories, because any number of them were published in The New Yorker, and you thought of them as short stories, only realized at a certain point
this
that it was really a novel?
To me. Yes, exactly. I was sure, well, I did this story, but now I want to write about this. But that has the same, you know, and then they would start to connect. Finally, I, in a rush, understood, and for the last 2 years, then compiled and put together all the material and realized that they were connected. And it was very exciting. It was maybe the most pleasurable book I'd ever written, partly because it's also a mystery. And I'd never really written a mystery before.
So here you are. You think you're not writing a novel. You wind up writing a mystery, which means you some complicated plotting. And on top of it all, you have given us a complete portrait of a town because you've done it with this approach. Perhaps if you had set out to do all of those things, you would have come up with a very different kind of book.
I think when I set out to do something, I'm intimidated and I try to do too grand a job on it, you know. And that's what happened with this other novel I was working on. I had grand aspirations. But in this book, I wanted to tell stories as simply as I could and to put them together and to approach this kind of material in as straightforward a way as I could. And I'm not a straightforward person, so that was not easy for me to do. I'm a little twisted.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never seen that side of you, Louise, but I'm sure it's true. How much of this novel is based on actual events? You explain in your introduction that a 13-year-old boy named Paul Holytracks, a name you've used in this book, was hanged by a mob in North Dakota in 1897.
That is true.
That's 14 years before.
And I wanted to use that name because there is there is something to bringing some attention to that forgotten and tremendously poignant figure. As I was writing this, the end of it, I kept looking. For the first time, I started using a computer to do research. I write by hand. You know, I haven't caught up with the rest of the world. But once I started searching for this, I came up with an actual photograph of these three native young, very young men. And it had sold on a Western website, Western Americana, for several thousand dollars. This particular old photograph, someone took a photograph.
Well, even his name suggests something else about Native American history, and that is the introduction of Christianity into the various reservations.
It does, although in this book I had to invent a reason for that name, but you know, it could have meant something entirely different in the Lakota or Dakota language. Most certainly these young men to whom this rough justice was meted out, these boys who were murdered, they were not Ojibwe, and I decided that I would move the situation to some place that I understood and really could write about. So it may have meant something entirely different.
You still have invented the town of Pluto.
Yes,
how did you come up with that name?
After I invented it, you know, after I came up with it, Pluto was demoted to
as a planet.
And I thought, well, there you go. Doesn't that just say something? You know, I invented it as a place that was not meant to be, of course, lonely and remote, but was named for one of the Greek gods. And that's what happened when the railroads came through platting out towns. They would choose different rocks or minerals or presidents to name the towns after.
Well, but Pluto was demoted as a planet, and this is a town that is pretty much disappearing.
It's a disappearing town, exactly.
But it's the kind of town, the small town, where every neighbor knows every other neighbor's business.
And history, and who is connected to who, and who was part of what side in that incident.
Do you think that this kind of town would decline no matter what, or was the decline set in motion by the violent events of 1911?
I don't think it was. You know, violent events really don't sort of destroy a town or a community. I think it was a simple case of economics. You know, the reservation begins to flourish in some way that the town can't, because they begin to get tax breaks for light industry. Different things happen, and the interstate highway passes this town by, and it just doesn't have the kind of situation for growth that it thought it would. And the judge who talks about the town and looks at it says, how strange that lives were lost in its formation in such a short time ago, you know, because here it's declining gracelessly, and soon it will be no more.
Well, reservations look like they were going to decline as well, but there seems to have been a certain stability in the various reservations, although I recently heard about two brothers, David and Anton Troyer, who are members of the Ojibwe nation, and they're working to preserve the Ojibwe language.
Yes.
How many people speak Ojibwe these days?
There's a renaissance, I think, in language preservation all through Native country. In David and Anton or Tony are doing everything they can to promote schools, it being taught in immersion schools, and it's being taught in a grassroots sort of way by activists and people who really love the language. And in Minneapolis, there are people teaching at the university level, the grade school level. There are immersion daycares.
And it can be transliterated into the Roman alphabet?
Well, it was long. I mean, that happened quite a while ago with Father Barraga, who came and did a dictionary, but there's a more recent dictionary that people use by Nichols and Nyholm dictionary published by the University of Minnesota. And this dictionary is something that everybody who's studying the language carries around constantly. You know, they're quite right. There's very few speakers over 50 who are native speakers, and people who are learning the language are going to learn it in a very different sort of way. You know, bring it back, but it will be a different language.
My guest is Louise Erdrich, whose latest novel is The Plague of Doves. It is published by Harper, and Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times has said it's your most ambitious and in many ways your most deeply affecting work yet. In fact, all of the reviews have been quite wonderful. Publishers Weekly called it a multi-generational tour de force of sin, redemption, murder, and vengeance. And here you are, Louise, telling me you had no idea when you started that any of that was going to happen.
Oh, no.
What about the four narrators? Is that just a, because you do use four narrators, is that simply a consequence of the fact that you started off writing short stories and you didn't know that you wanted to tell one story from different viewpoints?
I think that's the way I always tell books. You know, I rarely come to a book and tell it straight through. That's unusual. I like having different points of view and different people talking about an incident. I think it's sometimes difficult for a reader to go from one voice to the next. And so that's been the trouble, trying to hook them into the next voice quickly. But that's the way I tell stories. I don't really have a lot of control over how these work out for me. You know,
Well, if you hadn't grown up in this country, I might have asked if you'd come from another culture, whether that's because there was an oral tradition. But
I don't think so. I think it's because I heard a lot of people telling the same story, but would that be an oral tradition? I don't know. It was before the ubiquity of television, let's say, when people used to sit around and talk and tell stories a lot more often than perhaps they do now.
Well, in a story like this, it's important to know, to get many different viewpoints and to understand stories as they have been passed down within a family, and also as people remember them, the people who were involved.
And for me, there's an intimacy to that first, that each narrator, to their voice, you know, and I want to maintain that intimacy throughout the story.
A listener wants to know if lynchings of Indians were a common occurrence.
I have no idea.
Because we talk a lot about lynchings
exactly.
In the South.
Exactly. And I don't know how common. There aren't an enormous number of documented lynchings. I am quite sure that they were more common than anyone knows. This one was documented, and I wanted to point it out because it's quite a little known side of the American experience in the West.
The names of these characters are wonderful. Evelina Harp, Seraph Musham Milk, Anton Basil Kutz, John Wildestrand, almost seems Wildstrand seems
Wildstrand.
Yeah. Well, we have Marne Wold, yeah. Billy Peace, a man who has no peace.
A Billy Peace, a charismatic leader of who founds his own religion. He bases his own religion on channeling spirit and becomes a cult leader.
So are these the kinds of names that we would actually find in Montana?
You would find them, certainly. They're all actual names that I've got lists and lists of real names that I write down from newspapers and from old accounts of incidents like the actual Plague of Doves. That was a real incident. And I like collecting old names. These are just names that I came across in newspapers. I read newspapers all the time.
I said Montana, but it's North Dakota in this case, but it could just
it
as easily,
could just
it's
as
all
easily
that,
be
that
it's
area.
Yes.
You've included a note at the start of the novel indicating that proceeds for sales of this book will help support Birchback Books. That's a bookstore in Minneapolis?
That's right. That's the bookstore that I would say I own it, but actually it seems to own me. It's a small bookstore, about 800 feet, but we work out of the bookstore in a larger way, and it's a little independent.
And you also publish?
We also publish, and our publishing efforts are directed toward Ojibwe language preservation.
Now, whatever happened to the science fiction book? Is that ever going to be revived?
It's sitting right by my chair. It's kind of a lot of there's coffee cups resting on it, I suppose, right now. Mm-hmm. I'll see.
It means I may get back to you. I won't.
My daughters like it, so we'll see.
Meanwhile, you've written a whodunit, and who knew you were going to do that? So there are all sorts of genres available.
I didn't think I would. I'm surprised.
When did you realize that you were writing a whodunit and that you were going to have to reveal what really happened?
Well, you know, I have to say I owe this to Joyce Carol Oates, who chose one of the stories for Best American Mysteries. And I was so surprised, and Otto Penzler as well.
He was here yesterday,
by the way. Oh, he was.
Yeah, talking about pulps.
Oh, terrific. Well, you know, I was so surprised. And I said, I've written a mystery? Can that be? Yes, you've written a mystery. And they were both very kind about this, like, come on, dope. I got so excited that I actually had written something that had a plot that revealed something in the end, that I wrote the very first bit, which is called Solo. The last part of the, it was the last piece of writing in the book in order to set up the ending. So it was very satisfying. I was so satisfied with being able to do that.
That's better than going back and revising a first chapter in a draft to make it conform to everything else. Here you could just write the first chapter at the end.
It was very... I felt very lucky with it.
Are you writing other short stories now that may very well turn into another novel?
I've been working on selected new short stories. I've put together, that's the next book I'm working on. But, of course, I'm pretty sure these will never be a novel. They'll never come together.
Unless they do.
Unless they happen to.
Louise Erdrich's latest book is a novel. An accidental novel, but a real novel, and it works as a wonderful novel. It's called The Plague of Doves. It's published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a delight. Thank you.